Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories by Charles Dickens, The Signal Man and A Confession Found in a Prison. The Signal Man is a haunting story of uncertainty, fear, isolation, madness, trust, and respect. The narration is quite unique as it moves eerily from first person to third person with hardly any notice. The second story was the inspiration for The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. Enough said about that. And now, The Signalman by Charles Dickens. Halloa! Below there! When he heard a voice thus calling to him, he was standing at the door of his box, with a flag in his hand, furled round its short pole. One would have thought, considering the nature of the ground, that he could not have doubted from what quarter the voice came, but instead of looking up to where I stood on top of the steep cutting nearly over his head, he turned himself about and looked down the line. There was something remarkable in his manner of doing so, though I could not have said for my life what. But I know it was remarkable enough to attract my notice, even though his figure was foreshortened and shadowed down in the deep trench, and mine was high above him, so steep in the glow of an angry sunset that I had shaded my eyes with my hand before I saw him at all. Halloa! Below! From looking down the line, he turned himself about again, and raising his eyes, saw my figure high above him. Is there a path by which I can come down and speak to you? He looked up at me without replying, and I looked down at him, without pressing him too soon with a repetition of my idle question. Just then there came a vague vibration in the earth and air, quickly changing into a violent pulsation and an oncoming rush that caused me to start back as though it had force to draw me down. When such vapor as rose to my height from this rapid train had passed me and was skimming away over the landscape, I looked down again and saw him refurling the flag he had shown while the train went by. I repeated my inquiry. After a pause, during which he seemed to regard me with fixed attention, he motioned with his rolled-up flag towards a point on my level, some 200 or 300 yards distant. I called down to him, "All right!" and made for that point. There, by dint of looking closely about me, I found a rough zigzag descending path notched out, which I followed. The cutting was extremely deep and unusually precipitate. It was made through a clammy stone that became oozier and wetter as I went down. For these reasons, I found the way long enough to give me time to recall a singular air of reluctance or compulsion with which he had pointed out the path. When I came down low enough upon the zigzag descent to see him again, I saw that he was standing between the rails on the way by which the train had lately passed, in an attitude as if he were waiting for me to appear. He had his left hand on his chin, and that left elbow rested on his right hand, crossed over his breast. His attitude was one of such expectation and watchfulness that I stopped a moment, wondering at it. I resumed my downward way, and stepped out upon the level of the railroad, and drawing nearer to him, saw that he was a dark, sallow man, with a dark beard and rather heavy eyebrows. His post was in as solitary and dismal a place as ever I saw. On either side, a dripping wet wall of jagged stone, excluding all view but a strip of sky, the perspective one way only a crooked prolongation of this great dungeon, the shorter perspective in the other direction, terminating in a gloomy red light, and the gloomier entrance to a black tunnel, in whose massive architecture there was a barbarous, depressing, and forbidding air. So little sunlight ever found its way to this spot that it had an earthy, deadly smell, and so much cold rushed through it that it struck chill to me as if I had left the natural world. Before he stirred, I was near enough to him to have touched him. Not even then, removing his eyes from mine, he stepped back one step and lifted his hand. This was a lonesome post to occupy, I said, and it had riveted my attention when I looked down from up yonder. A visitor was a rarity, I should suppose, not an unwelcome rarity, I hope. In me, he merely saw a man who had been shut up within narrow limits all his life, and who, being at last set free, had a newly awakened interest in these great works. To such purpose I spoke to him, but I am far from sure of the terms I used, for besides that I am not happy in opening any conversation, there was something in the man that daunted me. He directed me a most curious look towards the red light near the tunnel's mouth, and looked all about it as if something were missing from it, and then he looked at me. "That light was part of his charge, was it not?" he answered in a low voice.
"Don't you know it is?"
The monstrous thought came into my mind as I perused the fixed eyes and the saturnine face that this was a spirit, not a man. I have speculated since whether there may have been infection in his mind. In my turn, I stepped back, but in making the action, I detected in his eyes some latent fear of me. This put the monstrous thought to flight.
"You look at me," I said, forcing a smile, "as if you had a dread of me."
"I was doubtful," he returned,
"whether I had seen you before."
"Where?"
He pointed to the red light he had looked at.
"There," I said.
Intently watchful of me, he replied, but without sound, "Yes."
"My good fellow, what should I do there? However, be that as it may, I never was there. You may swear."
"I think I may," he rejoined. "Yes, I am sure I may."
His manner cleared, like my own. He replied to my remarks with readiness and in well-chosen words. He had much to do there, yes. That was to say, he had enough responsibility to bear. But exactness and watchfulness were what was required of him, and of actual work, manual labor, he had next to none. To change that signal, to trim those lights, and to turn this iron handle now and then, was all he had to do under that head. Regarding those many long and lonely hours of which I had seemed to make so much, he could only say that the routine of his life had shaped itself into that form, and he had grown used to it. He had taught himself a language down here, if only to know it by sight, and to have formed his own crude ideas of its pronunciation, could be called learning it. He had also worked at fractions and decimals and tried a little algebra, but he was, and had been as a boy, a poor hand at figures. Was it necessary for him on duty always to remain in that channel of damp air, and could he ever rise into the sunshine from between those high stone walls? Why, that depended upon times and circumstances. Under some conditions there would be less upon the line than under others, and the same held good as to certain hours of the day and night. In bright weather he did choose occasions for getting a little above these lower shadows, but being at all times liable to be called upon by the electric bell, and at such times listening for it with redoubled anxiety, the relief was less than I would suppose. He took me into his box, where there was a fire, a desk for an official book in which he had to make certain entries, a telegraphic instrument with its dial, face, and needles, and the little bell of which he had spoken. On my trusting that he would excuse the remark that he had been well educated, and, I hoped I might say without offense, perhaps educated above that station, he observed that instances of slight incongruity in such wise would be rarely found wanting among large bodies of men, that he had heard it was so in workhouses, in the police force, even in that last desperate resource, the army, and that he knew it was so, more or less, in any great railway staff. He had been when young, if I could believe it, sitting in that hut, he scarcely could, a student of natural philosophy, and had attended lectures, but he had run wild, misused his opportunities, gone down, and never risen again. He had no complaint to offer about that. He had made his bed, and he lay upon it. It was far too late to make another. All that I have here condensed, he said in a quiet manner, with his grave, dark regards divided between me and the fire. He threw in the word "sir" from time to time, and especially when he referred to his youth, as though to request me to understand that he claimed to be nothing but what I found him. He was several times interrupted by the little bell, and had to read off messages and send replies. Once he had to stand without the door, and display a flag as a train passed, and make some verbal communication to the driver.
In the discharge of his duties, I observed him to be remarkably exact and vigilant, breaking off his discourse at a syllable and remaining silent until what he had to do was done. In a word, I should have set this man down as one of the safest of men to be employed in that capacity, but for the circumstance that while he was speaking to me, he twice broke off with a fallen color, turned his face towards the little bell when it did not ring, opened the door of the hut, which he kept shut to exclude the unhealthy damp, and looked out towards the red light near the mouth of the tunnel. On both of these occasions he came back to the fire with the inexplicable air upon him which I had remarked, without being able to define when we were so far asunder. Said I, when I rose to leave him, "You almost make me think that I have met with a contented man." I am afraid I must acknowledge that I said it to lead him on.
"I believe I used to be so," he rejoined, in the low voice in which he had first spoken. "But I am troubled, sir. I am troubled."
He would have recalled the words if he could. He had said them, however, and I took them up quickly. "With what? What is your trouble?"
"It is very difficult to impart, sir. It is very, very difficult to speak of. If ever you make me another visit, I will try to tell you."
"But I expressly intend to make you another visit. Say, when shall it be?"
"I go off early in the morning, and I shall be on again at 10 tomorrow night, sir."
"I will come at 11. He thanked me and went out the door with me.
"I'll show my white light, sir," he said in his peculiar low voice, "till you have found the way up. When you have found it, don't call out. And when you are at the top, don't call out."
His manner seemed to make the place strike colder to me, but I said no more than, "Very well."
"And when you come down tomorrow night, don't call out. Let me ask you a parting question. What made you cry, 'Halloa, below there,' tonight?"
"Heaven knows," said I. "I cried something to that effect."
"Not to that effect, sir. Those were the very words. I know them well."
"I admit those were the very words. I said them, no doubt, because I saw you below."
"For no other reason?"
"What other reason could I possibly have?"
"You had no feeling that they were conveyed to you in any supernatural way?"
"No." He wished me good night and held up his light. I walked up the side of the line of rails, with a very disagreeable sensation of a train coming behind me, until I found the path. It was easier to mount than to descend, and I got back to my inn without any adventure. Punctual to my appointment, I placed my foot on the first notch of the zigzag next night as the distant clocks were striking 11. He was waiting for me at the bottom with his white light. "I have not called out," I said, when we came close together. "May I speak now?"
"By all means, sir."
"Good night, then, and here's my hand."
"Good night, sir, and here's mine."
With that, we walked side by side to his box, entered it, closed the door, and sat down by the fire.
"I have made up my mind, sir,"
he began, bending forward as soon as we were seated and speaking in a tone but a little above a whisper,
"that you shall not have to ask me twice what troubles me. I took you for someone else yesterday evening. That troubles me."
"That mistake?"
"No, that someone else."
"Who is it?"
"I don't know."
"Like me?"
"I don't know. I never saw the face. The left arm is across the face, and the right arm is waved, violently waved, this way."
I followed his action with my eyes, and it was the action of an arm gesticulating with the utmost passion and vehemence, "For God's sake, clear the way!"
"One moonlight night," said the man, "I was sitting here when I heard a voice cry, 'Halloa, below there.' I started up, looked from that door, and saw this someone else standing by the red light near the tunnel, waving as I just now showed you. The voice seemed hoarse and shouting, and it cried, 'Look out, look out!' And then again, 'Halloa, below there, look out!' I caught up my lamp, turned it on red, and ran towards the figure, calling, What's wrong? What has happened?
Where?
It stood just outside the blackness of the tunnel. I advanced so close upon it that I wondered at its keeping its sleeve across its eyes. I ran right up at it and had my hand stretched out to pull the sleeve away when it was gone.
Into the tunnel, said I.
No. I ran on into the tunnel 500 yards. I stopped and held my lamp above my head and saw the figures of the measured distance and saw the wet stains stealing down the walls and trickling through the arch. I ran out again faster than I had run in, for I had a mortal abhorrence of the place upon me. And I looked all round the red light with my own red light, and went up the iron ladder to the gallery atop of it, and came down again, and ran back here. I telegraphed both ways. An alarm has been given. Is anything wrong? The answer came back both ways. All well.
Resisting the slow touch of a frozen finger tracing out my spine, I showed him how that this figure must be a deception of his sense of sight, and how that figures originating in disease of the delicate nerves that minister to the functions of the eye were known to have often troubled patients, some of whom had become conscious of the nature of their affliction, and had even proved it by experiments upon themselves. As to the imaginary cry, said I, do but listen for a moment to the wind in this unnatural valley, while we speak so low, and to the wild harp it makes of the telegraph wire.
That was all very well, he returned, after we had sat listening for a while, and he thought to know something of the wind and the wires. He so often passed long winter nights there, alone and watching. But he would beg to remark that he had not finished. I asked his pardon, and he slowly added these words, touching my arm.
Within 6 hours after the appearance, the memorable accident on this line happened, and within 10 hours the dead and wounded were brought along through the tunnel over the spot where the figure had stood.
A disagreeable shudder crept over me, but I did my best against it. It was not to be denied, I rejoined, that this was a remarkable coincidence, calculated deeply to impress his mind, but it was unquestionable that remarkable coincidences did continually occur, and they must be taken into account in dealing with such a subject. Though to be sure I must admit, I added, for I thought I saw that he was going to bring the objection to bear upon me, men of common sense do not allow much for coincidence in making the ordinary calculations of life. He again begged to remark that he had not finished. I again begged his pardon for being betrayed into interruptions.
This, he said, again laying his hand upon my arm and glancing over his shoulder with hollow eyes, was just a year ago. 6 or 7 months passed, and I had recovered from the surprise and shock, when one morning, as the day was breaking, I, standing at the door, looked towards the red light and saw the spectre again.
He stopped with a fixed look at me.
Did it cry out?
No, it was silent.
Did it wave its arm?
No. It leaned against the shaft of the light with both hands before the face, like this.
Once more I followed his action with my eyes. It was an action of mourning. I have seen such an attitude in stone figures on tombs.
Did you go up to it?
I came in and sat down, partly to collect my thoughts, partly because it had turned me faint. When I went to the door again, daylight was above me and the ghost was gone.
But nothing followed. Nothing came of this.
He touched me on the arm with his forefinger twice or thrice, giving a ghastly nod each time.
That very day, as a train came out of the tunnel, I noticed at a carriage window on my side what looked like a confusion of hands and heads, and something waved. I saw it just in time to signal the driver, "Stop!" He shut off and put on his brake. But the train drifted past here 150 yards or more. I ran after it, and as I went along, heard terrible screams and cries. A beautiful young lady had died instantaneously in one of the compartments, and was brought in here and laid down on this floor between us.
Involuntarily, I pushed my chair back as I looked from the boards at which he pointed to himself.
True, sir, true. Precisely as it happened, so I tell it you.
I could think of nothing to say, to any purpose, and my mouth was very dry.
The wind and the wires took up the story with a long, lamenting wail.
He resumed. Now, sir, mark this, and judge how my mind is troubled. The spectre came back a week ago. Ever since, it has been there now and again by fits and starts.
At the light?
At the danger light.
What does it seem to do?
He repeated, if possible, with increased passion and vehemence, that former gesticulation of, "For God's sake, clear the way." Then he went on.
I have no peace or rest for it. It calls to me for many minutes together in an agonized manner. Below there, look out, look out! It stands waving to me, it rings my little bell.
I caught at that. Did it ring your bell yesterday evening when I was here, and you went to the door?
Twice.
Why, see, I said, how your imagination misleads you. My eyes were on the bell, and my ears were open to the bell, and if I am a living man, it did not ring at those times. No, nor at any other time except when it was rung in the natural course of physical things by the station communicating with you.
He shook his head.
I have never made a mistake as to that yet, sir. I have never confused the spectre's ring with the man's. The ghost's ring is a strange vibration in the bell that it derives from nothing else, and I have not asserted that the bell stirs to the eye. I don't wonder that you failed to hear it. But I heard it.
And did the spectre seem to be there when you looked out?
It was there.
Both times? He repeated firmly.
Both times.
Will you come to the door with me and look for it now?
He bit his under lip as though he were somewhat unwilling, but arose. I opened the door and stood on the step while he stood in the doorway. There was the danger light. There was the dismal mouth of the tunnel. There were the high, wet stone walls of the cutting. There were the stars above them.
Do you see it? I asked him, taking particular note of his face. His eyes were prominent and strained, but not very much so, perhaps, than my own had been when I had directed them earnestly toward the same spot.
No, he answered. It is not there.
Agreed, I said. We went in again and shut the door and resumed our seats.
I was thinking how best to improve this advantage, if it might be called one, when he took up the conversation in such a matter-of-course way, so assuming that there could be no serious question of fact between us.
By this time you will fully understand, sir, he said, that what troubles me so dreadfully is the question, what does the spectre mean?
I was not sure, I told him, that I did fully understand.
What is it warning against?
He said, ruminating with his eyes on the fire, and only by times turning them on me.
What is the danger? Where is the danger? There is danger overhanging somewhere on the line. Some dreadful calamity will happen. It is not to be doubted this third time, after what has gone before. But surely this is a cruel haunting of me. What can I do?
He pulled out his handkerchief and wiped the drops from his heated forehead.
If I telegraph danger on either side of me or on both, I can give no reason for it.
He went on, wiping the palms of his hands.
I should get into trouble and do no good. They would think I was mad. This is the way it would work. Message. Danger. Take care.
Answer. What danger? Where?
Message. Don't know, but for God's sake, take care. They would displace me. What else could they do?
His pain of mind was most pitiable to see. It was the mental torture of a conscientious man, oppressed beyond endurance by an unintelligible responsibility involving life.
When it first stood under the danger light,
he went on, putting his dark hair back from his head and drawing his hands outward across his temples in an extremity of feverish distress.
Why not tell me where that accident was to happen, if it must? Why not tell me how it could be averted, if it could have been averted? When on its second coming it hid its face, why not tell me instead? She is going to die, let them keep her at home. If it came on those two occasions only to show me that its warnings were true, and so to prepare me for the third, why not warn me plainly now? And I, Lord, help me, a mere poor signal man on this solitary station. Why not go to somebody with credit to be believed and power to act?
When I saw him in this state, I saw that for the poor man's sake, as well as for the public safety, what I had to do for the time was to compose his mind. Therefore, setting aside all question of reality or unreality between us, I represented to him that whoever thoroughly discharged his duties must do well, and that at least it was his comfort that he understood his duty, though he did not understand these confounding appearances. In this effort I succeeded far better than the attempt to reason him out of his conviction. He became calm. The occupations incidental to his post as the night advanced began to make larger demands on his attention, and I left him at 2 in the morning. I had offered to stay through the night, but he would not hear of it. That I more than once looked back at the red light as I ascended the pathway, that I did not like the red light, and that I should have slept but poorly if my bed had been under it, I see no reason to conceal. Nor did I like the 2 sequences of the accident and the dead girl. I see no reason to conceal that either. But what ran most in my thoughts was the consideration how ought I to act, having become the recipient of this disclosure. I had proved the man to be intelligent, vigilant, painstaking, and exact, but how long might he remain so in his state of mind? Though in a subordinate position, still he held a most important trust, and would I, for instance, like to stake my own life on the chances of his continuing to execute it with precision? Unable to overcome a feeling that there would be something treacherous in my communicating what he had told me to his superiors in the company, without first being plain with himself and proposing a middle course to him, I immediately resolved to offer to accompany him, otherwise keeping his secret for the present, to the wisest medical practitioner we could hear of in these parts, and to take his opinion. A change in his time of duty would come round next night, he had apprised me, and he would be off an hour or two after sunrise, and on again soon after sunset. I had appointed to return accordingly. Next evening was a lovely evening, and I walked out early to enjoy it. The sun was not yet quite down when I traversed the field path near the top of the deep cutting. I would extend my walk for an hour, I said to myself, half an hour on and half an hour back, and it would then be time to go to my signal man's box. Before pursuing my stroll, I stepped to the brink and mechanically looked down from the point from which I had first seen him. I cannot describe the thrill that seized upon me when close at the mouth of the tunnel I saw the appearance of a man with his left sleeve across his eyes, passionately waving his right arm. The nameless horror that oppressed me passed in a moment, for in a moment I saw that this appearance of a man was a man indeed, and that there was a little group of other men standing at a short distance to whom he seemed to be rehearsing the gesture he made. The danger light was not yet lighted. Against its shaft, a low hut, entirely new to me, had been made of some wooden supports and tarpaulin. It looked no bigger than a bed. With an irresistible sense that something was wrong, with a flashing, self-reproaching fear that fatal mischief had come of my leaving the man there and causing no one to be sent to overlook or correct what he did, I descended the notched path with all the speed I could. "What is the matter?" I asked the men.
"Signalman killed this morning, sir."
"Not the man belonging to that box?"
"Yes, sir."
"Not the man I know?"
"You will recognize him, sir, if you knew him,"
said the man who spoke for the others, solemnly uncovering his own head and raising an end of the tarpaulin,
"for his face is quite composed."
"Oh, how did this happen? How did this happen?" I asked, turning from one to another as the hut closed in again.
"He was cut down by an engine, sir. No man in England knew his work better, but somehow he was not clear of the outer rail. It was just at broad day. He had struck the light and had the lamp in his hand, and the engine came out of the tunnel, his back is towards her, and she cut him down. That man drove her and was showing how it happened. Show the gentleman, Tom."
The man, who wore a rough, dark dress, stepped back to his former place at the mouth of the tunnel.
"Coming round the curve of the tunnel, sir," he said. "I saw him at the end, like as if I saw him down a perspective glass. There was no time to check speed, and I knew him to be very careful. As he didn't seem to take heed of the whistle, I shut it off when we were running down upon him, and called him as loud as I could.
What did you say?
Well, I said, below there, look out, for God's sake, clear the way.
I started.
Oh, it was a dreadful time, sir. I never left off calling to him. I put this arm before my eyes not to see him, and I waved this arm at the last, but it was no use.
Without prolonging the narrative to dwell on any one of its curious circumstances more than any other, I may, in closing it, point out the coincidence that the warning of the engine driver included not only the words which the unfortunate signalman had repeated to me as haunting him, but also the words which I myself, not he, had attached, and that only in my own mind, to the gesticulation he had imitated. I hope you enjoyed The Signalman by Charles Dickens. We now present to you A Confession Found in a Prison by Charles Dickens. I held a lieutenant's commission in His Majesty's Army and served abroad in the campaigns of 1677 and 1678. I returned home, and returning from the service, withdrew to a small estate lying a few miles east of London, which I had recently acquired in right of my wife. This is the last night I have to live, and I will set down the naked truth without disguise. I was never a brave man, and had always been from my childhood of a secret, sullen, distrustful nature. I speak of myself as if I had passed from the world, for while I write this, my grave is digging, and my name is written in the black book of death. Soon after my return to England, my only brother was seized with mortal illness. This circumstance gave me slight or no pain, for since we had been men, we had associated but very little together. He was open-hearted and generous, handsomer than I, more accomplished, and generally beloved. Those who sought my acquaintance abroad or at home, because they were friends of his, seldom attached themselves to me long, and would usually say in our first conversation that they were surprised to find two brothers so unlike in their manners and appearance. It was my habit to lead them on to this avowal, for I knew what comparisons they must draw between us, and having a rankling envy in my heart, I sought to justify it to myself. We had married two sisters. This additional tie between us, as it may appear to some, only estranged us the more. His wife knew me well. I never struggled with any secret jealousy or gall when she was present, but that woman knew it well as I did. I never raised my eyes at such times, but I found her fixed upon me. I never bent them on the ground or looked another way, but I felt she overlooked me always. It was an inexpressible relief to me when we quarreled, and a greater relief still when I heard abroad that she was dead. It seemed to me now as if some strange and terrible foreshadowing of what has happened since must have hung over us then. I was afraid of her. She haunted me. Her fixed and steady look comes back upon me now, like the memory of a dark dream, and makes my blood run cold. She died shortly after giving birth to a child, a boy. When my brother knew that all hope of his own recovery was past, he called my wife to his bedside, and confided this orphan, a child of 4 years old, to her protection. He bequeathed to him all the property he had, and willed that in case of the child's death it should pass to my wife, as the only acknowledgment he could make her for her care and love. He exchanged a few brotherly words with me, deploring our long separation, and being exhausted fell into a slumber from which he never awoke. We had no children, and as there had been a strong affliction between the sisters, and my wife had almost supplied the place of a mother to this boy, she loved him as if he had been her own. The child was ardently attached to her, but he was his mother's image in face and spirit, and always mistrusted me. I can scarcely fix the date when the feeling first came upon me, but I soon began to be uneasy when this child was by. I never roused myself from some moody train of thought, but I marked him looking at me, not with mere childish wonder, but with something of the purpose and meaning that I had so often noted in his mother. It was no effort of my fancy, founded on close resemblance of feature and expression. I never could look the boy down.
He feared me, but seemed by some instinct to despise me while he did so, and even when he drew back beneath my gaze, as he would when we were alone, to get nearer to the door, he would keep his bright eyes upon me still. Perhaps I hide the truth from myself, but I do not think that when this began I meditated to do him any wrong. I may have thought how serviceable his inheritance would be to us, and may have wished him dead, but I believe I had no thought of compassing his death. Neither did the idea come upon me at once, but by very slow degrees presenting itself at first in dim shapes at a very great distance, as men may think of an earthquake or the last day. Then, drawing nearer and nearer, and losing something of its horror and improbability, then coming to be part and parcel, nay, nearly the whole sum and substance of my daily thoughts, and resolving itself into a question of means and safety, not of doing or abstaining from the deed. While this was going on within me, I never could bear that the child should see me looking at him, and yet I was under a fascination which made it a kind of business with me to contemplate his slight and fragile figure, and think how easily it might be done. Sometimes I would steal upstairs and watch him as he slept, but usually I hovered in the garden near the window of the room in which he learned his little tasks, and there, as he sat upon a low seat beside my wife, I would peer at him for hours together from beneath the tree, starting like the guilty wretch I was at every rustling of a leaf, and still gliding back to look and start again. Hard by our cottage, but quite out of sight, and, if there were any wind astir of hearing too, was a deep sheet of water. I spent days in shaping with my pocket knife a rough model of a boat which I finished at last and dropped in the child's way. Then I withdrew to a secret place, which he must pass if he stole away alone to swim this bauble, and lurked there for his coming. He came neither that day nor the next, though I waited from noon till nightfall. I was sure that I had him in my net, for I had heard him prattling of the toy, and knew that in his infant pleasure he kept it by his side in bed. I felt no weariness or fatigue, but waited patiently, and on the third day he passed me, running joyously along with his silken hair streaming in the wind, and he singing, God have mercy upon me, singing a merry ballad, who could hardly lisp the words. I stole after him, creeping under certain shrubs which grow in that place, and none but devils know what terror I, a strong, full-grown man, tracked when I placed him there, tracked the footsteps of that baby as he approached the water's brink. I was close upon him, and had sunk upon my knee and raised my hand to thrust him in, when he saw my shadow in the stream and turned him round. His mother's ghost was looking from his eyes. The sun burst forth from behind a cloud. It shone in the bright sky, the glistening earth, the clear water, the sparkling drops of rain upon the leaves. There were eyes in everything. The whole great universe of light was there to see the murder done. I know not what he said. He came out of bold and manly blood, and child as he was, he did not crouch or fawn upon me. I heard him cry that he would try to love me. Not that he did. And then I saw him running back towards the house. The next I saw was my own sword naked in my hand, and he lying at my feet, stark dead, dabbled here and there with blood, but otherwise no different from what I had seen him in his sleep. In the same attitude, too, with his cheek resting upon his little hand. I took him in my arms and laid him, very gently now that he was dead, in a thicket. My wife was from home that day and would not return until the next. Our bedroom window, the only sleeping room on that side of the house, was but a few feet from the ground, and I resolved to descend from it at night and bury him in the garden. I had no thought that I had failed in my design, no thought that the water would be dragged and nothing found, that the money must now lie waste, since I must encourage the idea that the child was lost or stolen. All my thoughts were bound up and knotted together in one absorbing necessity of hiding what I had done, how I felt when they came to tell me that the child was missing, when I ordered scouts in all directions, when I gasped and trembled at everyone's approach. No tongue can tell, or mind of man conceive. I buried him that night. When I parted the boughs and looked into the dark thicket, There was a glowworm shining like the visible spirit of God upon the murdered child. I glanced down into his grave when I had placed him there, and still it gleamed upon his breast, an eye of fire looking up to heaven in supplication to the stars that watched me at my work. I had to meet my wife and break the news and give her hope that the child would soon be found. All this I did, with some appearance, I suppose, of being sincere, for I was the object of no suspicion. This done, I sat at the bedroom window all day long and watched the spot where the dreadful secret lay. It was in a piece of ground which had been dug up to be newly turfed, and which I had chosen on that account, as the traces of my spade were less likely to attract attention. The men who laid down the grass must have thought me mad. I called to them continually to expedite their work, ran out and worked beside them, trod down the earth with my feet, and hurried them with frantic eagerness. They had finished their task before night, and then I thought myself comparatively safe. I slept, not as men do who awake refreshed and cheerful, but I did sleep, passing from vague and shadowy dreams of being hunted down to visions of the plot of grass through which now a hand, and now a foot, and now the head itself was starting out. At this point I always woke and stole to the window to make sure that it was not really so. That done, I crept to bed again, and thus I spent the night in fits and starts, getting up and lying down full 20 times, and dreaming the same dream over and over again, which was far worse than lying awake, for every dream had a whole night's suffering of its own. Once I thought the child was alive, and that I had never tried to kill him. To wake from that dream was the most dreadful agony of all. The next day I sat at the window again, never once taking my eyes from the place, which, although it was covered by the grass, was as plain to me, its shape, its size, its depth, its jagged sides and all, as if it had been open to the light of day. When a servant walked across it, I felt as if he must sink in. When he had passed, I looked to see if his feet had not worn the edges. If a bird lighted there, I was in terror lest by some tremendous interposition it would be instrumental in the discovery. If a breath of air sighed across it, to me it whispered murder. There was not a sight or a sound, how ordinary, mean, or unimportant soever, but was fraught with fear, and in that state of ceaseless watching I spent 3 days. On the fourth, there came to the gate one who had served with me abroad, accompanied by a brother officer of whom I had never seen. I felt that I could not bear to be out of sight of the place. It was a summer evening, and I bade my people take a table and a flask of wine into the garden. Then I sat down with my chair upon the grave, and being assured that nobody could disturb it now without my knowledge, tried to drink and talk. They hoped that my wife was well, that she was not obliged to keep her chamber, that they had not frightened her away. What could I do but tell them with a faltering tongue about the child? The officer, whom I did not know, was a down-looking man, and kept his eyes upon the ground while I was speaking. Even that terrified me. I could not divest myself of the idea that he saw something there which caused him to suspect the truth. I asked him hurriedly if he supposed that, and stopped. "That the child had been murdered," said he, looking mildly at me. "Oh, no, what could be gained by murdering a poor child?" I could have told him what a man gained by such a deed, no one better, but I held my peace and shivered as with an ague. Mistaking my emotion, they were endeavoring to cheer me with the hope that the boy would certainly be found. Great cheer that was for me. Then, when we heard a low, deep howl, and presently there sprung over the wall 2 great dogs, who, bounding into the garden, repeatedly baying sounds we had heard before. "Bloodhounds," cried my visitors. What need to tell me that? I had never seen one of that kind in all my life. But I knew what they were and for what purpose they had come. I grasped the elbows of my chair and neither spoke nor moved. "They are of genuine breed," said the man whom I had known abroad, "and being out for exercise have no doubt escaped their keeper." Both he and his friend turned to look at the dogs, who with their noses to the ground moved restlessly about, running to and fro and up and down and across and round in circles, careening about like wild things, and all this time taking no notice of us.
but ever and again repeating the yell we had already heard, then dropping their noses to the ground again and tracking earnestly here and there. They now began to snuff the earth more eagerly than they had done yet, and although they were still very restless, no longer beat about in such wide circuits, but kept nearer to one spot, and constantly diminished the distance between themselves and me. At last they came up close to the great chair on which I sat, and raising their frightful howl once more, tried to tear away the wooden rails that kept them from the ground beneath. I saw how I looked in the faces of the two men who were with me.
"They sent some prey," said they both together.
"They sent no prey," I cried.
"In heaven's name, move," said the one I knew very earnestly, "or you will be torn to pieces."
"Let them tear me limb to limb. I'll never leave this place," cried I.
"Are dogs to hurry men to shameful deaths? Hew them down, cut them in pieces."
"There is some kind of foul mystery here," said the officer, whom I did not know, drawing his sword.
"In King Charles' name, assist me to secure this man."
They both set upon me and forced me away, though I fought and bit and caught at them like a madman. After a struggle, they got me quite between them, and then, my God, I saw the angry dogs tearing at the earth and throwing it up in the air like water.
What more have I to tell? That I fell upon my knees and with chattering teeth confessed the truth and prayed to be forgiven? That I have since denied and now confess to it again? That I have been tried for the crime, found guilty and sentenced? That I have not the courage to anticipate my doom or bear up manfully against it? That I have no compassion, no consolation, no hope, no friend? That my wife has happily lost for the time those faculties which would enable her to know my misery or hers? That I am alone in this dungeon with my evil spirit, and that I die tomorrow?
And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Signalman and A Confession from a Prison by Charles Dickens. And if that last story whetted your appetite for the Telltale Heart, you can find a recording that I did 1 year ago, this October 31st, which was my first radio show. And I did the Telltale Heart along with the Raven. And that is available at my podcast at notyourmotherstorytime.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is Not Your Mother's Storytime.